Welcome to the Hanover Messianic Ministries audio presentation of the devotional study series entitled The First Regathering, Modern Israel. In this portion of our study, Hanover Messianic Ministries Director Pastor Bob Morris will continue tracing the events in modern history that we call the Modern Zionist Movement. He will conclude the Zionist portion of Israel's first regathering in 1947 and begin to discuss the events God orchestrated to bring Israel to formal statehood in 1948. Following the teaching session, you'll be given information explaining how to contact Hanover Messianic Ministries with your questions and to order additional resources. Now let's begin lesson number 10. Here's Pastor Bob Morris.
The year is 1939. World War II is about to begin. In relation to the State of Israel, one of the key events that we're going to look at is the London Round Table Conference. We are now on lesson 10 of our class, The First Regathering, The Modern State of Israel. The London Round Table Conference was convened by Britain in order to impose in some way a decision regarding what would happen to the Jewish claim for the land of Israel and the competing Arab claim for the land of Israel. London decided that if they could, they would impose a policy decision, more than likely dividing the land in half into a Jewish state and an Arab state. As the London Roundtable Conference got going, Colonial Secretary MacDonald admitted that Britain's policy was to placate the Arabs so that their holdings in the Suez Canal and their oil supply would be safe as they saw war approaching. The result of the roundtable discussions was the MacDonald White Paper, which severely hampered the Zionist movement and the feasibility of the Jewish state. And even though it was very negative to the survival, it was in fact a mortal threat to the survival of a Jewish state, the Arab Higher Committee chose to denounce the White Paper on the basis that there would be too much immigration, too much Jewish influence in the land. And of course the Zionists rejected the paper as well on the opposite reasoning, too little immigration. That brought us to the end of lesson number 9, and now let's move on to lesson number 10. And we'll take a look at the Lechomei Cherut Yisrael, Lechi, and its foundation. Now, beyond the control of the Jewish agency itself, there emerged a number of activist splinter groups at this time. They were limited in number, but they were fanatical in purpose. They were unwilling any longer to accept discipline, Zionist discipline, at a time when Jewish people were being exterminated in Europe and the British government was barring the doors of Palestine to survivors of Europe. So these groups adopted the technique of violence. Now, the most ungovernable faction of this underground movement that was just emerging was a group known as the Fighters for the Freedom of Israel, known simply as Lehi, for its Hebrew initials. Fighters for the Freedom of Israel. They consisted of barely 300 members, and they were just one of a handful of Jewish paramilitary organizations that sprung up immediately or during the Arab insurrection of 1939. But they're probably the most famous. Its founder was a man named Avraham Stern. And so his guerrilla group was most commonly known as the Stern Gang. Stern was a blonde, Polish-born Jew in his early 30s. He came to the conclusion that all emphasis should be placed on anti-British rebellion. No other Jewish underground group was willing to go that far, not even Etzel. But the Stern Gang's hatred of the British transcended all reason and all control. So they began operating at this time. Let's move on to the year 1941 and the organization of the Palmach. As World War II progressed, the British suffered stunning defeats in North Africa at the hands of the German tank commander Erwin Rommel. Throughout the long and painful ordeal, British retreated, and as the British retreated, they derived no encouragement from their Arab allies. They received no encouragement from their treaty partners. King Farouk of Egypt, essentially an ally of Europe, communicated admiration and support for Hitler. Iraq was intensely anti-British. But no alignment with the Axis was more avid, more complete than the one carried out by the Mufti of Jerusalem. So the British were sorely tried at this time, but they were not without local support in the Middle East. The Jewish community proved loyal. We faced a common enemy. The Jewish agency mobilized the Yishuv's resources. They mobilized them for wartime, agricultural, and industrial action. In the first month of the war, the National Council, the Va'ad Le'umi, announced the registration of volunteers for national service, and 136,000 men and women enrolled. Now, their motivation was not simply an understandable desire for battle against the Nazis, but their motivation was the expectation that an armed and active Jewish force would obligate Britain to reconsider the Zionist case. And additionally, military skills acquired during the war could be put to good use later. It was the Jewish agency's hope to organize these troops as a separate force under its own flag, something similar to the Zionist Mule Corps in World War I. When the military situation turned against Britain, senior Haganah officers were invited to collaborate with the British in preparing lists of bridges and tunnels that were vulnerable to sabotage. These bridges and tunnels were located in Lebanon, Syria, Turkey, and Iran. That was the first of other joint efforts. In the early spring of 1941, Rommel's Panzer Army launched its operations in the western desert, and Nazi infiltration of Syria became overt. And so Haganah cooperation was urgently needed. The need soon became evident for a permanently mobilized Jewish task force, and such a unit accordingly was established by the Haganah in May 1941. It was classified as the Palmach, the Plugot Machatz, the strike companies. It was an elite force, and the commander of this new elite force was, not surprisingly, Yitzhak Sadeh. As in the 1930s, the veteran night fighter immediately set about recruiting the Haganah's ablest young men, mainly from the kibbutzim. In July 1942, Rommel's forces were hurled back at Al Alamein, and in four months, they were later driven out of Libya altogether by the 8th Army under the command of Lieutenant General Bernard Montgomery. And so the danger to Palestine ebbed in the summer of 1942. And when it did, the British closed the various Palmach training bases. And the British then relegated the Haganah to its previous illegal status. Refusing dissolution, however, the Jewish Defense Force simply became underground once again. Its members had swelled to 21,000 men and women at this time. The Palmach also remained intact. They remained intact at various kibbutzim scattered around the country. They trained secretly. They organized a clandestine naval program. They developed the beginning of an air arm under the facade of an aviation club. And by then, having worked closely with the British, the Haganah and the Palmach leadership understood better the ways in which a European regular army functioned. They understood the strengths and weaknesses of such an army. In 1942, massacres occurred in Russia, and the death camps of Auschwitz, Majdanek, and Treblinka began to function at full capacity. And in relation to the functioning of the death camps, we've learned now that the British Broadcasting Corporation may have underreported the Holocaust because of fear upsetting the Arab world. This was recently aired on a program on the BBC in June 1995. Frank Roberts, a wartime Foreign Office official, revealed in the interview in 1995, quote, "We wanted to keep the Middle East quiet. We had to be careful we didn't give the Arabs the impression that we'd suddenly turned into a pro-Jewish, pro-Zionist organization." And so the BBC may have deliberately underreported what was happening in the Holocaust again because of fear of upsetting the Arab world. British fear that their lifeline of oil and the Suez Canal would be lost. Also in 1942, the Struma sinks in the Black Sea with 769 refugees. This is a very sad incident. And this incident, which occurred in 1942, became for the Yishuv the very symbol of Britain's unrelenting wartime policy toward refugees. It happened this way. On December 16, 1941, the SS Struma entered the harbor of Istanbul and dropped anchor. She was an unseaworthy vessel weighing 180 tons. Several weeks before, the Struma had departed the Romanian port of Constanta, and it had limped along the Black Sea coast with Palestine as its ultimate goal. Then its engine began to malfunction and its hull began to leak, and so the Struma was forced to anchor for repairs. The ship was packed with 769 refugees. They were planning a voyage across the high seas. The ship was unable to proceed further, and so the Jews implored the Turkish government for sanctuary. That appeal was turned down. They were barred from going forward to Palestine. They were unwilling to return, and so the Struma passengers remained in the Istanbul harbor for 2 months, suffering from hunger, from overcrowding, and panic. The Jewish agency implored the British to allow the refugees entrance into Palestine, if only for transshipment, if only to temporarily stay there and be shipped out to another destination outside of Palestine. But the mandatory government refused. Eventually, on February 24, 1942, the Turks ordered the Struma towed out of the harbor. 5 miles beyond the coastline, the ship took on water and sank, with the loss of 428 men, 269 women, and 70 children. The horrified reaction of Palestinian Jewry was echoed in other Allied countries. Even in Britain, the tragedy was angrily debated in the House of Commons. Let's move to 1944. In 1944, Etzel and Lehi begin to strike at the British. After 1942, the Lehi, the underground guerrilla organization known as the Stern Gang, concluded that violence was the one method capable of driving the British from Palestine. So in November of 1944, the Lehi perpetuated their most audacious crime. It took place in Cairo. It was directed against Lord Moyne, the British minister resident. On November 6, 1944, two Stern Gang members shot Moyne fatally as he was leaving his British residence. These two young men were placed on trial in Cairo on January 10, 1945, swiftly convicted, swiftly hanged. With few exceptions, the Zionist community was horror-stricken at Moyne's assassination. Ben-Gurion issued a passionate appeal to the Yishuv to cast out all members of this underground gang and deny them shelter and assistance. Thereupon, the Haganah launched a full-scale attack against Etzel, against the Irgun, and against the Lehi members alike, denouncing them to the British police. But the damage to the Zionist cause was already great, already very far-reaching. Jewish goodwill had come to an end, and the British patience was now exhausted. Now, upon the invasion of Italy in the autumn of 1943, the front line shifted north from the Arab countries. On July 12, 1944, therefore, Churchill sent a memorandum to the war secretary instructing him to begin organizing a Jewish army group. And so a Jewish brigade was organized to fight in Italy. A recruiting and training program was launched, and in early 1945, the 3,400 Palestinian members of the brigade were shipped off for combat duty in Italy. They were attached to the British 8th Army. As it turned out, this Jewish fighting force represented the important political accomplishment of Zionist diplomacy during war. This was the number one important political accomplishment during the war. Equipped with its own staff services and artillery support, it became the training ground for hundreds of Jewish officers and NCOs. It was here that they first mastered the logistics, organization, and tactics necessary to operate a large-scale army. The experience also added to the Haganah reservoir of trained fighting men. And this was a great preparation for any post-war struggle against the British or against the Arabs. In World War II came to an end in 1945. And following the end of World War II, Europe was teeming with displaced persons. Therefore, refugee traffic from the east to German relocation camps gained momentum. In the summer of 1945, nearly 100,000 Jewish displaced persons had reached Germany. At the same time, the Labour Party in Britain had won a stunning upset victory, and this revived hopes in the Yishuv dramatically. Ben-Gurion declared exultantly, "The British workers will understand our aims. British labor will understand us." So the community that now demanded recognition in Palestine was no longer a precarious minority settlement. In 1944, the Jewish population of Palestine had reached 560,000 people, over 500,000. And as a result, Ben-Gurion led a deputation to London. He carried with him a request for the immediate admittance into Palestine of the 100,000 Jewish displaced persons. On August 25, 1945, the Colonial Office replied with an offer of 2,000 immigrant certificates and a supplementary monthly quota of 1,400, provided the Arabs agreed. The Zionist request was for 100,000 people to be allowed into the land. The Colonial Office said, "We will allow 2,000, 2% into the land, and maybe 1.4% a month if the Arab states agree." This response dumbfounded and appalled the Zionist leadership. By then, a guideline for the entire Middle East had already been prepared by the current Labor Foreign Secretary, Ernest Bevin. His policy accepted as unquestionable, unchallengeable, the importance of maintaining friendship with the Arab world. His position was that Britain could in no way, allow any friction between them and the Arab world. And one reason was economic. In 1945, Britain was virtually bankrupt. So one of Bevin's priority concerns during this very grim post-war era was to assure the security of the single most important of Britain's remaining overseas resources, and this was oil. This was the power source for the country's very industrial existence. It was a foreign currency earner of near sacred importance. Now, Britain's vast holdings were concentrated in the Middle East, partly in Iran, but largely in the vast Kirkuk field in Iraq, in Kuwait, and in Qatar. The need for oil and pipeline easements was one factor in determining Bevin's Middle Eastern policy. Another factor was geopolitical strategy. And this revolved around the fact that the Soviet Union was emerging as a potentially far more serious threat to Britain's military and economic dominance of the Middle East. Bevin felt that Britain's influence in the Middle East had to be protected at any cost. In the United States, in early 1945, the State Department had already firmly moved to a position of anti-Zionism. Undersecretary Joseph Grew warned the Roosevelt administration that, quote, "Zionist activities in this country will remain the gravest threat to friendly relations between the United States and the countries of the Near East until a solution to the problem is reached." Unquote. For the previous 2 years, a series of research studies on Palestine had been conducted by the State Department, Interdivisional Committee. In their summary of January 1945, the committee members urged that Palestine be stipulated as an international territory under United Nations trusteeship. President Roosevelt was vague on the issue. Roosevelt assured Ibn Saud of Saudi Arabia that he would not adopt a hostile stance to the Arabs, and that Washington would not alter its basic approach toward Palestine, quote, "without full and prior consultation with both Jews and Arabs," end quote. Roosevelt subsequently remarked that, quote, "on account of the Arab situation, nothing could be done in Palestine," end quote. Historians are probably correct when they state there were serious doubts that Israel would have come into being if Roosevelt had lived. Harry Truman's approach to the problem was less equivocal. He'd been a pro-Zionist since his early manhood. Truman sent Churchill a brief note on July 24, 1945, expressing hope that the British government would, quote, "take steps to lift the restrictions of the White Paper into Palestine." Before a reply could be sent, Churchill was defeated in the general election. Soon afterward, Truman dispatched Earl G. Harrison to study the conditions of the Jewish displaced Persians. Harrison's report not only indicted American military insensitivity, but also laid out a number of uncompromising proposals for solving the refugee problem. With thinly veiled indignation, Harrison described the appalling circumstances of the death camp survivors, their despair, their frantic activity to leave the European morgue. At least 100,000 of them, the report suggested, ought to be evacuated immediately, and, quote, "Palestine is definitely and preeminently the first choice," end quote. Truman endorsed the proposal without qualification. In a letter to Prime Minister Attlee on August 31, 1945, the president urged that 100,000 Jews be allowed into Palestine forthwith. The appeal took Attlee by surprise, so much so that it required 2.5 weeks until Bevin in the Foreign Office could prepare a response. The reply offered a clue to London's emerging approach to the Palestinian question. It rejected the notion that Jewish displaced persons had suffered more than non-Jewish victims of Nazism, and it rejected the plea to allow the 100,000 into the Holy Land. It would have been useful if Bevin had exercised verbal restraint, rather than warn on November 2, 1945, quote, that if the Jews, with all their suffering, want to get too much at the head of the queue, you have the danger of another anti-Semitic reaction through it all, end quote. This remark elicited a day of mourning in the Yeshuv. The result was that illegal immigration intensified. Now, even before World War II, the Zionist leadership had sponsored illegal immigration. Illegal immigration of Jews from Europe and the Middle East, known as Aliyah Beit, Immigration Plan B. Immigration Plan B was simply a euphemism for non-official and illegal immigration. By autumn of 1945, the first groups of several hundred refugees were taken out of their camps in the American zone of Germany. In trucks supplied by the Jewish Brigade, they were carried to the French and later to Austrian borders. Here they made their way over mountain passes. They made their way on foot to be transported afterward to the French or Italian coasts and to waiting Haganah ships. The largest number of Haganah vessels were Italian coastal ships of pre-war vintage. These were obsolescent tubs. They were hardly fit to make a Mediterranean crossing. It appeared unthinkable to load them with hundreds of passengers. Nevertheless, they were hastily repaired in various Italian shipyards, and they were sent to their embarkation rendezvous. These were usually secluded inlets near large Adriatic ports. The initial sailings of these ships caught the British by surprise. Half a dozen ships slipped by the British coastal watch in Palestine during the late autumn and early winter of 1945 and 46, unloading some 4,000 refugees. In 1945, the Zionist leadership had rightly concluded that if Britain's attitude was based upon Arab strength, then Britain must be equally impressed by Jewish strength. For the first time, the agency approved specific measures of physical resistance. Thus, in November 1945, the commanders of the Haganah and the two dissident Jewish underground forces reached an agreement that all future Etzel, Irgun, all future Etzel and Lehi operations would be coordinated under Haganah direction. And in the next 8 months, these three groups undertook systematic attacks on British installations. The British promptly sent military reinforcements. The British government's retaliation became increasingly severe. And yet, underground agents were rarely caught. General Baker, the commanding officer in Palestine, had to admit later that, quote, "The Jews knew all government secrets and military plans within a day of our making the decision. Their intelligence system is uncanny," end quote. And so the attacks continued, hitting police, army, and naval garrisons. Until the post-war period, they had been accustomed to thinking of violence in Palestine as exclusively an Arab phenomena, and so the force and savagery of the Jewish resistance came as a shock to them. Let's move on to 1946. In 1946, London formulated a new compromise approach to Truman's request. On October 26, 1945, before the House of Commons, and on November 13, in a letter to the American president, Attlee proposed a joint Anglo-American committee to investigate the tragedy of the refugees and devise a solution for it. Truman accepted the challenge with the qualification that Palestine alone, rather than any alternative refuge, become the focus of inquiry. Attlee and Bevin grudgingly accepted this condition. A unanimous report of less than 100 pages was issued May 1, 1946. It recommended the immediate authorization of 100,000 immigration certificates. The Anglo-American report was categorically rejected by London. London thought up this whole idea, and then London rejected the findings of their own committee. The text of the document was published in Washington on May 1, 1946. And the same day, Truman publicly announced his approval of the recommendations for admitting 100,000 displaced persons into Palestine. E.F. Francis Williams, Bevin's friend and biographer, wrote that Truman's statement, quote, "threw Bevin into one of the blackest rages I ever saw him in," end quote. On July 22, 1946, a group of armed Irgun, a group of armed Etzel members, entered the kitchen of the King David Hotel in Jerusalem. An entire wing of this building was occupied by government offices, together with the offices of the CID, the Criminal Investigation Division. The saboteurs deposited heavy milk cans packed with Gelgenite in the hotel's lower quarters. Time fuses were set and the men departed. According to Begin's later account, a warning of the impending explosion was telephoned to the CID. The British denied that the warnings were ever received. The explosion went off in the hotel 25 minutes later. 91 Britishers, Arabs, and Jews were killed. 45 were injured. The Jewish agency was horrified. The British government was horrified by the King David Hotel bombing. Ben-Gurion, who had never brought himself totally to disavow earlier underground raids on British installations, now furiously condemned the Irgun and urged Palestine Jewry to turn its members in whenever they were discovered. Early in 1946, the British intensified their blockade against illegal immigration. With nearly 8,000 displaced persons sailing from Italian ports by then, interception was almost certain, usually just inside Palestine territorial waters. These refugees were then forcibly transferred to British vessels and carried off to Cyprus. All but five of the 63 refugee ships that sailed were intercepted between 1945 and 1948. This resulted in the internment of 26,000 DPs, displaced persons, in Cyprus. This was precisely the message that the Zionists were wanting to convey, a refugee tragedy. The impact of these 26,000 DPs in a refugee camp thundered against the British government. even the British taxpayer turned out to be the Jewish people's most effective weapon to gain the support of world opinion. Well, I see that our time is coming to a close, so let's bring this lesson to a close. We'll pick up the lesson in 1947, and next lesson we will move from the Zionist era into the era of the formation of the State of Israel in 1948. So we'll pick up that part of the history of the modern State of Israel in our next tape.
Thank you, Pastor Bob. It's our aim at Hadavar Messianic Ministries to deepen your understanding of God's Word and to better equip you to share the Messiahship of Jesus with your Jewish friends, relatives, co-workers, and neighbors. To order additional tapes or for more information, you can contact Hadavar Messianic Ministries at hadavar@hadavar.org. That's hadavar@hadavar.org. Or write to Hadavar Messianic Ministries at 14804 Sand Canyon Avenue, Irvine, California, 92618. Or simply call us at 949-559-1701. Again, that number is 949-559-1701. Again, thanks for listening to this audio presentation of the First Regathering Modern Israel, brought to you by Hadavar Messianic Ministries.